Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. I'm your host, Nathaniel R., and it's a special Midwestern edition of the show this week. I have with me Nick Davis.
That's right, the people have the power.
And Chris Vile.
Hello.
Now, Chris,
your podcast needs to start appealing to white working class cinephiles in the Midwest. That's your problem.
Do a tour of all flyover states.
I see. Well, I'm originally from Michigan, so I count, sort of.
Nathaniel, you always count.
Joe and Katie couldn't make it today, so Chris, who you've been reading on the blog for a year now, has been great.
Yeah.
He is joining us this morning. Well, first, before we get to Silence, we probably should mention something about the Globes, but after a whole week of discussion, maybe what is there left to say?
Did Meryl Streep give a speech at all? I can't remember if she was there.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a good show, and it was definitely interesting in terms of the Oscar race in what it did not clear up exactly.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, we knew ahead of time that La La Land was the strength going in terms of the Oscar frontrunner.
Right.
But there were many other things that were a little more unexpected, such as Hooper and Aaron Taylor-Johnson.
Did you ever think you would say what you just said? Hooper and Aaron Taylor-Johnson?
I'm horrified to put the names together. I apologize. I understand Aaron Taylor-Johnson is, like, a lovely guy in real life, from what I've heard. Mm-hmm. I just don't really understand the nomination, let alone the win.
Well, not to put everything onto lurid sources, but haven't we all heard this story that Tom Ford mailed all the members a sort of swag bag of Tom Ford products that then had to be mailed back because it was in excess of the dollar amount that's allowed? So they were all quote-unquote mailed back, but look at all those nominations for Nocturnal Animals.
He's just mailing everywhere, too. He mailed it all the way across to the Brits at BAFTA.
That's true. His FedEx is working hard.
So maybe we will move on to the DGA. Were you at all surprised by the nominations? I would say that I was not, although I was a little bit expecting Mel Gibson to show up.
I think with the addition of a first-time director category, it was a little surprising to see Garth Davis show up in both, but that probably just speaks to how strong Lion is when people don't expect it to be.
I wouldn't necessarily have predicted Villeneuve if I were predicting, but I'm not shocked, but that was a kind of pleasant surprise over people who seem like they've had a little bit more traction, I guess.
Yes.
To get into that final five.
And do you think these... do you feel confident that it will transfer? I'm worried about Villeneuve, even though I don't really understand why he would be less of a sure thing than other people, because it seems like the type of film that people would think of as a director's film. So it seems a little odd to me that people seem to think of him as in fifth place.
Yeah.
I kind of get it. It's just a couple of strange factors. I think we have this perception that the Academy is cold to him, or at least to his movies. And I think people are kind of discrediting it because it's a female-led narrative and it's genre, and I don't necessarily know if that'll translate.
But I don't...
Do you think Gibson will show back up for the Academy?
I do not.
I didn't either. Okay.
I mean, the way the Oscars directing branch is, I would say I expected he'd have a much easier time with DGA.
Yeah.
And the same is true of Scorsese, actually. Although I suppose that he could still show up, I just don't know how many times, like... Okay, let me just put this out there. I don't dislike...
You do it.
I don't dislike Silence. But I wonder... So I'm speaking of this very sort of without emotion. but I wonder how many times someone can rally the voters of sort of, you know, it's a passion project. Isn't that kind of like a very common narrative for Scorsese movies? When Gangs of New York came out, that the narrative was like, oh, he's been trying to make this forever. Like, he's loved the book forever. He's been talking about it for 20 years. And when Last Temptation of Christ, everybody's like, oh, it's so personal. I just feel like so often people are rallying around him as like, around him rather than the end product. And I just wonder how many times you can use that. How many nominations can you garner with that being your narrative? It's like, but it's me, you know, and I made another, you know, thing I'm passionate about.
I don't know. Am I
making any sense?
Yeah.
No, I think I get it now. Yeah. I'm not sure that would be as much of a deterrent as the fact that people seem weirdly undermotivated to see it. And that it tanked so unbelievably badly. Although I still can't help wondering if there's an American Sniper that suddenly is everywhere, having been nowhere, it feels like it would be that movie to me. But, you know, American Sniper was also on its way to being an enormous hit. And this is like, you can't even twist people's arms to go, mm-hmm. which I'm just kind of surprised about.
I'm with Nick that I think the uphill battle for that movie is just getting people to see it, because the interest just seems so low and it's coming on so late. Mm-hmm. So it seems more like it would be, rather than playing into the passion play or people who love Scorsese, it's just, I don't know, there's just a very low urgency to see that movie for mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I only saw it very recently, and it took, you know, a friend of mine who I knew would really want to see it because of the topic, not because of Scorsese. It took him, like, let's go today, and I was like, okay, because I just haven't been motivated, which I know, which, like, will immediately get me votes down, thumbs down from a lot of people, But I think we're all entitled to have auteurs we're more motivated by than others.
Of course.
And Scorsese is just not very high on my list, because I haven't really loved anything for about, I guess, 11 years now. So, yeah. But I sat there watching it, and I just felt very... how to put this without sounding horrible... I felt unmotivated to see it even while I was seeing it, if that makes any sense. I didn't dislike it. It just kind of... And I wasn't even bored, which I realized the length is a problem. Like, I thought the length was a non-issue to me while I was sitting there. But I just... I guess it felt kind of inert to me. Like, I wanted something more from it. I guess I just didn't feel a lot watching it, and all the sort of emotional political anguish and, you know, imperialism and all of these thorny issues that come into the base story. Yeah. I felt we had to wait really long into the movie for those to come into play. Because then I was interested. Like, I might have gotten bored if the last, like, half hour, 40 minutes or so weren't so thorny. But before then, I just felt very like, this is exactly what I was expecting to see, and it's not surprising me at all. I don't know. Somebody else talk.
I definitely get where you're coming from in the interest factor. I think one of my struggles with it, even though I really liked it, there's not a whole lot. There's a lot of complex issues that, like, he's toying with a lot of these interesting ideas about, like you said, imperialism and faith, but the tone doesn't really shift. So it felt kind of monolithic in a way that I just wish that it had been a little bit more. I guess I'm not getting at it. There wasn't.
Impassioned?
No, it definitely felt impassioned to me, but it kept hitting the same note with every moment, I guess, and every different nuance to Andrew Garfield's struggle. It just all felt like it was coming from the same place, whereas, you know, you were seeing a lot of sides of this.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the arc was, yeah, now that you're saying it, the arc was kind of a problem. It didn't build for me. It just was one thing the whole time.
Mm-hmm. If anything, those more... When it got really wordy, you kind of wished for more of that, like, opening sequence part where you just let the visuals kind of speak for it, because it said way more than, to me, when you have these very long conversations about a lot of the same things with small tweaks, I guess, mm-hmm. or small nuances added to the conversation. I'm also trying to be kind of vague for spoilers, because I'm sure a lot of people haven't seen it yet.
If they want to. Yeah, I don't dispute that the movie you guys are describing is the one I watched too, but I guess I just reacted more favorably to it. Like, I sometimes think that Scorsese's desire to really punch up tone or draw out an arc leads to movies that feel too pushy to me. Mm-hmm. And like, nothing was actually happening in Hugo, for example, but we had to be cued all the time as though all kinds of things were happening and amazing adventures were unfurling before our eyes. Like, nothing's happening in this movie. And this felt like, in a way, repeated incidents or a circumstance that nobody could get out of. But I did feel the kind of slow creep intensifying of it really affected me. There were things I didn't love about the movie, and I kind of argued with it a little bit, but it wasn't the same thing you're describing, even though I see what you're describing. I felt like it had a weird relationship to so many things about it. Felt so studiously period, and then these performance styles, especially from the Driver and Garfield, that I definitely felt clear we were not in the medieval times when they would act. And and then, like, weird. I like that Scorsese likes to just, like, show up to set sometimes and be like, I thought of a weird thing we can do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's really exciting, but sometimes that leads to, like, Enya's marble halls playing in The Age of Innocence. And there were some Enya's marble halls, definitely, when, like, Jesus would start talking. Or yeah. There's a kind of intense zoom in the very final shot that I felt it was hard not to just think was tacky.
Yeah.
If you remember.
I would agree with that. Okay. Yeah. I definitely thought the last shot was quite a problem, because I think what it was trying to say to us was, at least to me, was clear.
Abundantly evident.
Without seeing the shot. And I also, you know, reacted negatively to hearing. We won't say how it comes into play, but there are a couple narrated bits from Jesus, and that makes it sound so tacky. It didn't feel like...
Well...
Yeah.
I will say that some of the times the voiceover was taking me out of it when I was actually really into what was happening. Like, my favorite scene, I think, although it's not my favorite scene because of the voiceover, there's a character in the movie, for those who haven't seen it yet, who is constantly betraying his faith and then constantly confessing about the fact that he betrayed his faith. It's a side character, so it's not that big of a spoiler. But in one scene, Andrew Garfield's taking his confession, and there's all this great, it's my favorite part of Andrew Garfield's performance, because there's all this great sort of just complete raging annoyance with the person.
Yeah.
And he's trying to grapple with the fact that he's still going to perform his priestly duties of listening to this confession, which he knows won't mean anything, because the person will just go back to the way they are. But then there's this voiceover explaining all this to you.
I forgot that.
And yeah. of like, you know, why should I listen to this man type of thing. Like, sort of Andrew Garfield talking to himself or something. I didn't quite understand all of why the voiceovers were there. I guess it was his writing after the fact or something. Like his diaries, I'm not sure. But I just found it so annoying, because I was just watching, it was one of the most minimalistic parts of Garfield's performance, and I just felt totally red. And then he was explaining it to me at the same time, and it just was really irritating, because it seemed like something small enough that you wouldn't feel the need to egg it on.
Yep.
Like, not even about clarity, but just like a small enough moment that just let that moment
that's
be.
That's all about hitting a note really strongly already. Yes. Like, there are ambiguous moments in the movie.
Yes.
That's not one of them. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I felt Scorsese was, like, really restrained at other times with, like, the fact that there's not much score to speak of at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which I actually was quite pleased by. And, you know, that can be hard to pull off in movies, but I thought it worked here.
Especially for a lot of those moments where there isn't really heavy dialogue, or you might just have these kind of whispery voiceover moments, too, that you would think kind of call for these, like, broader, like, scored moments that you've maybe seen from Scorsese in the past. And, yeah, I also appreciated that minimalism.
Well, especially because his movies are so music-driven so often.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with that, it made, with that choice, like, I did see in the credits that someone was credited with the score, but I personally didn't hear a score ever, except for, like, you know, I forget what it's called when it's within the scene. Like, you know, music within the scene, like, people, like, humming or singing a hymn.
Diegetic?
Diegetic. Except for that, I didn't really notice any music, and which to me made like the sound, the actual diegetic sounds, like the waves constantly, since they were so often by the ocean, made it so much more effective. That made it feel somehow more like, you know, earthy,
kind of ambient.
Yeah, and earthy, like you were actually there on this like sort of despairing coast, you know.
Well, it sounds like you were. At times.
I didn't hate it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I came across as far more negative about the film than I am. I feel kind of strongly, but I think one of my issues with this movie is that it might need either time to sit or a second viewing, which I don't think is going to help its Oscar chances.
Mm-hmm.
Unless
yeah.
And other people don't have that experience, but that's definitely kind of my experience with the film.
I mean, we could all be proven wrong in a week, but I agree with you now, and it also feels like a double whammy where it's not going to be the kind of movie that will resonate, just like Kundun wasn't, but then it doesn't seem to serve the movie to come out right now, which it's only coming out right now because of that.
Yeah.
And it might really have been something to handle in September or October.
Or February.
Or even February, I guess.
Like, people sit with it for a long time.
Although, Nathaniel, you're talking to two Midwesterners who deal with a different kind of winter than you do, and it's a little hard to imagine being like, I know what I want to go do today in February. But yeah, this is not the moment to, like, the Hidden Figures Rogue One moment is not the Silence moment, it feels like, to me.
Yeah, it's also, unfortunately, maybe not the 20th Century Women moment.
Which is, like, a perfect movie!
I'm never just gonna stop telling people that it is, like, you know, a year from now, people are gonna be like, how did that not get every nomination? It's so great.
Which I felt a version of pretty strongly about Beginners, but even compared to that, this is like, give it everything. And I already thought, when I'd only seen the trailer, that should have been winning the screenplay prize from every critics group, just the trailer. And now
that you've seen
it, I just can't relate to this not having won or been up for a writing prize. Like, what is...
Yeah, the screenplay
is... people think writing is something different than I think it is? Like...
I think the screenplay is, like, and it has so many great elements, but this screenplay might be its best element.
Oh!
I haven't seen it yet, but Nick, you mentioned the trailer, and I've probably seen this trailer to maybe every movie that I've seen in the past month, and it is about the only one that seems to get an audience response. They laugh, and, like, there's conversation afterwards, too, so... Again, I don't understand why it's not resonating with people just from that aspect, because it does seem like at least in my audience, is the type of thing that
people are, I was like, going to say, people
responding to.
People in my audience for Silence this week were very like reactive to the trailer. So they showed this. They were showing Ghost in the Shell trailer.
Oh, yeah.
With Scarlett Johansson. And you know, the first image in that trailer is that weird, like, it looks like sort of...
The, like, geisha robot?
Yeah, it's like a geisha robot, but it looks like something that could be out of a Saw movie, the way that it's shot, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's right... Annabelle. Yeah, because it's right in your face is, like, and this... and they showed it after the trailer for that, what looks like an alien ripoff, that Life movie with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yet another movie about a scientist who's the only person in the world skilled enough to go on that mission, but nobody said, like, don't touch the fucking alien. Don't put your finger on the fucking alien. Like, I would have thought that's benchmark number one, but we never learned this. Sorry, go ahead.
So, yeah, they showed a bunch of... Oh, and there was a trailer for Split with M. Night Shyamalan's, like, Split personality movie. And this thing that I hadn't even heard of, this Dane DeHaan movie where he's like underwater or something. I didn't really understand what was going on.
I love horror movies, so I do want to see that movie, but that trailer drives me insane. Every time the caption is from visionary director Gore Verbinski. Sure. Fine.
Yeah, that word gets a little, yeah. That word.
He envisioned Mouse Hunt.
So anyway, so they had showed all these trailers, and it, like, as soon as that geisha robot is right in your face at the beginning of Ghosts in the Shell, this woman behind us is like, I'm going to have nightmares, all these scary images. Why are they showing all these horrible things?
She's about to see something just very quaint. Just,
you know. Yeah, she came to the right place.
Right.
Doesn't open torture, you know.
Yeah. Although given how violent some of Scorsese's work has been, I will say that I actually was pleasantly surprised how less graphic it was than I was expecting. The torture in Silence. Yeah.
Maybe he saw Hacksaw Ridge while he was in the editing room and was like, I've had a different thought that we could scale back.
Well, that's an interesting point too, because especially you're talking about this, you know, Christian version of torture or Christian version of martyrdom. And that's such an interesting contrast between the two of how to do it so that it's not gratuitous and not through the eye that Mel Gibson sees a lot of violence and violence. Because I didn't get that at all from this, and I was a little worried going into it that I would get that from Silence.
Oh, I was too, and, you know, it's funny, because I was complaining, you know, back when Passion of the Christ came out, I was very upset by how just, like, gory it was. But I will admit that, you know, after watching Hacksaw Ridge and Silence, maybe, like, the violent gore stuff would have been more appropriate to Silence than to Hacksaw Ridge, which is about pacifism, whereas a lot of, like, you know, Christianity symbols and stuff are actually about suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Like the cross, for example. So it just, yeah, I mean, that was one of my main problems with Hacksaw Ridge, but I feel like we've been through Hacksaw Ridge enough, so I apologize. did you guys see Patterson?
It opens here next week.
Okay.
Same.
So no.
So you haven't seen it yet either, Chris?
No, it opens here next week as well.
Yeah. So I wonder if Ohio and Illinois, you guys are on the same schedule.
Is it super gory? Is that what made you think of it?
No. I just wanted someone to talk to you about it, because I guess I just don't really get Jim Jarmusch movies. I actually liked it, but I always come out of them like, huh. And I never sort of move away from the huh part.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did really, really like Only Lovers Left Alive.
Oof.
Yeah. Mm. I'm with you on Jarmusch there. I think that's about the only one that comes to mind that I really had anything to say about.
No, yeah. Ghost Dog fans in this conversation.
I never actually watched Ghost Dog.
Oh, it's really important, not only because it's just phenomenal in so many ways, and I usually am a little bit cool toward Jarmusch too, but also because when you're watching Forrest Whitaker act in other movies, and you start to be like, I want all my money back from each movie I've seen. You can go to Ghost Dog and be like, well, that's true. I mean, Last King of Scotland too, but I'm starting to work on a, like, just kind of academy for people who are, like, brilliant a couple times, but, like, terrible almost every other time, and I just don't understand, like, the metaphysics of that. Like, Cage, Whitaker, Swank, like, how, what goes on? Like, yeah, you forget how to do what you're good at most of the time you do it.
Yeah, I had that one. Like, Forrest Whitaker in Rogue One, I just was like, oh, please stop. Like, at every moment and every scene, I was like, stop, stop.
When I saw Arrival for the second time, I was even more thrown by whatever was coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, he was minor enough in that it didn't take me out of it, but my God, he wants you to be thinking of him during Rogue One at every second.
Holy shit. And even the part of me in Rogue One that was like, oh, like, I can step back and see that I think it's kind of interesting that this movie's willing to show us that the rebels are often kind of hotheads and crazy people. And, like, there's a lot more mixture of tone across the two sides.
Yeah.
Like, there might be a reason that you would ask somebody to, like, heighten it a little bit. But I don't think they asked for that. I can't imagine asking for that.
I try not to follow the behind-the-scenes gossip, like, reshoot stuff, but from what I gather, all of his footage that ended up in the movie was completely reshot.
Oh. Yeah. That makes it even worse to me. Why would that be your preferred take?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, because coming from the director... I didn't see Monsters, but coming from the director of Godzilla, I wouldn't really think of Gareth Edwards as somebody who would be like, ooh, let's go for really big acting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 20th Century Women.
It's going to be hard to not let me put it this way, it does not deserve to be viewed under an Oscar lens. It's so beautiful. It just is its own little stone cold masterpiece of a little movie.
Response that I see to it seems to be really strong. Why do you guys think it's either not showing up or not connecting enough to show up to people?
I mean, it's definitely another case of, like, I'm truly perplexed why they didn't put it out faster, since we know it was ready and was the centerpiece at New York. And, I mean, it definitely is, like, the work of somebody who's making a story about things he's held on to for the rest of his life. So maybe he held on to this a little bit back. I don't know. And, like, the editing is so complicated and the editing
didn't even get nominated at the Editor's Guild Award.
I mean, what are we even talking about at that point?
Yeah.
But, so maybe he was still tweaking or something, but it just seems like primary as, like, this is a November movie. This is an October, November movie. Like, let people sit with it. Let people tell their friends about it. Clear word of mouth movie. So I don't understand the release. But, the title isn't helping it. I don't know.
Yeah, the title could be throwing people, because it makes it sound so...
Like Bicentennial Man or something.
Yeah, it's a little dry for something that warm. I mean, I get the title. The title totally 100% reads while you're watching the movie.
Absolutely.
But as just if you don't know anything about the movie, it's kind of like, oh. But it just seems like the type of movie... It could be because it's playing to every single thing that I love in movies, you know? What was I trying to say? It seems to me like the type of thing that people in 5 years will consider one of their favorite movies. So, like, just going to be sad that it's not considered a favorite movie right now.
Yeah. I also, like, I doubt everybody thinks about this as much as we imagine that they do, but I just wondered if somewhere at some, what is it, Roadside Attractions, who put it out? I don't remember, but...
A24.
If this looked like a Crazy Heart, Still Alice will release this at the last second of the last second and remind everybody that they love her and she doesn't have an Oscar yet, and it'll go from there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that movie and it's not that year, so that was never going to work.
Right.
But I don't know, I've just been trying to grasp at straws because it just seems like they were sitting on a gold mine.
Yeah, I mean, from a very brief conversation I had with someone at A24, I think the entire issue was Moonlight.
I was going to ask.
Because the Moonlight, you know, publicity was revving up right when the sort of the New York Film Festival thing was happening. And I think they just had their hands full. That is my read on it.
Oh.
Which is despairing because they're both such great movies, like, and so much so far ahead of other movies out this year that, you know, there should be room for both.
Yeah, I guess that's the limitation of being a kind of smaller outfit that tries to give a lot of personal attention to each movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, hopefully it might, this is my hope that Annette Bening magically shows up in the nominations, which is still possible because if you see that performance, like, how are you not going to nominate it? And then the movie does get the sort of what people were hoping from, like, last minute, like, oh, wow. I mean, it's not going to win anything, of course, but...
Yeah.
Because it's too late for, you know, that narrative to take hold, but... it would be great if it was in the history books in some way, in terms of Oscar, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe Meryl Streep could just put out a little press release that says, I forgot to thank Annette Bening for writing my speech. Who is so modest and self-effacing.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that, Chris, you won't be able to speak to this because you haven't seen it, but Nick, one thing I did want to ask your opinion about, because it's actually my favorite part of the movie, and I have heard from naysayers about the movie...
What?
There are people who don't like 20th Century Women.
And do they live in the hills of Japan and hide in caves?
No, two of them actually write for the Film Experience. So when people act like I'm required to... Like somebody called the Film Experience an echo chamber the other day, and I was like, actually, no, I don't require people to love any particular movie.
That was about how we all hate Nocturnal Animals, right?
Yeah.
I remember that comment.
Yeah, so two, I'm not going to name them, but two of our writers of the Film Experience really don't like 20th Century Women.
And, okay. Spice of Life.
Right. And one, and both of them cited the voiceovers as something they hated. And to me, that was the most brilliant part of the movie. And normally, I'm like very allergic to voiceover. But the voiceover content in 20th Century Woman is completely outside of the narrative. It's always like the five different characters are giving you details about the other character's life and trying to sort of give you a biography from their, from their understanding of like before and after the movie and how they became who they are and what became of them. And I thought it was such a fascinating way to contextualize people's lives and personalities, and also get that we can't really know other people.
Yep.
Like, we can try, and so, like, all of the, you know, the Greta Gerwig character is a photographer, and one of her projects in the movie is she's taking photographs of everything that she owns as a way to describe her, a self-portrait through things that are hers. And to me, like, that tiny little side element and the narration, and it all adds up to such a beautiful and unique sort of writerly perspective about who people are.
It was literally the next thing I was going to mention too, as loving about the movie. And I, it's like, I didn't think it was an overbearing movie about this, although I guess there is a, it's not, it's clear that it's a theme, but, but this kid has so many, like, both not enough people in his life and too many.
Yeah.
And there is this sense of, nobody really wanting to take ownership of his life, but a lot of people doing it anyway. And those voiceovers, in the way that they all have different kinds of authorities and they're situated clearly and unclearly at different times, it just felt like it wasn't hammering at home, because the movie's not like oppressive or dogmatic about how it uses them, but you do realize like how many different people are kind of pulling on some thread of his life as if they are authorities on it, even when they're talking about their own lives. That this is just I just loved all that. It reminded me of, like, it doesn't work the same way, but it reminded me of the different voiceovers in All About Eve, and how you can't ever at any point in that movie fit them together, and it's just multiply authored, which is part of why nobody can work out what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was great. And even in the way they're used in the final sequence, which is a little more conventional, mm-hmm. The effect on me was just so tremendous.
Yeah,
sorry, Chris, you're being very patient.
Yeah,
no, that's okay. I was going to say, I mean, this isn't an aspect that I've read too much about the film, but as someone who hasn't seen it yet, and, you know, knowing that it's a movie that's kind of about the unknowability of people, I'm actually really curious now to see how the multi-character narration kind of plays into that.
Yeah, I couldn't love it more. I just want to say that. So totally. I really hope everyone listening will go see this movie when it finally opens near you, and remember that, you know, Oscars aren't everything, and a lot of movies that received zero nominations are still with us, and everybody still loves them.
And my other favorite thing about it is how, partially because of the way it's edited and written, so the scenes, in a way that I think a lot of people really like about Manchester too, even though I like it even more here, are pretty short, mm-hmm. but that means there can be more of them, and they don't actually all have to point in the same direction or even trend in an obvious direction as you go. And then within those scenes, because of the way that he edits his movies, like, you get, you know, and usually we wouldn't like this because, or I don't know if we wouldn't like it, but we spend so much time talking about our craving for more shots that get held and are not cut up.
Right.
But in this case, cutting six different times to Annette Bening in the same short dialogue scene, such that she's allowed to have an almost completely different tone in each of five or six line readings, and we can leave that scene understanding that all of that was happening, that it was funny, and she was sad, and she was perplexed, and she understood the interaction better than the person talking to, but also understood it less well. Like, that was so, like, yes and no, you know? Like, that was so amazing. And the other thing I liked the most about it was that, like, we've talked often about what a great year this is for actresses, which, fantastic. But, like, even more than that, it just drove home to me how many movies have come out this year that have credited a female protagonist with, like, all of this historical memory and consciousness of the world at the moment that she's alive. Like, mm-hmm. Things to Come does that, Aquarius does that, Arrival does that, Jackie does that. Like, that's a really rare thing for movies to allow women to do increasingly, and the mm-hmm. fact that that's happened so often is, I didn't even like all those movies equally, but I just am so grateful that we've gotten to have that experience over and over again this year.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Someone's going to steal that, Nick, and write a whole essay on it.
Somebody whose name rhymes with Nathaniel.
Someone who has more time than Nathaniel.
Yeah.
But someone's definitely going to write that now. So you better, unless you want to, then you better hurry.
Yeah, copyright, you guys, okay? I just trademarked what I said.
Creative Commons.
Because the way the internet works is that when you have an idea, it belongs to you, and nobody can touch it.
Any last thing you guys have seen that you want to mention? I know people are catching up this time of year, and they're just cramming screenings in.
I've been trying to cram as much as I can and cram some rewatches in, but I watched Aquarius last night. You just brought that up, Nick. It's amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's on Netflix. That's listening. Watch Aquarius right now.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's on Netflix?
Yeah, yesterday, yeah. I believe it premiered on Netflix. Ugh, love it.
I was one of only two people in the theater when I saw it, and I am now friends with the person who was the other person in the theater, because we obviously talked for like 25 minutes before. Like, are you here? What made you come since nobody else came? Well, Sonia Braga is a genius. Okay, well, obviously, where is everybody? And so then we sat together, and then we talked for like half an hour after, and then we emailed each other, and Aquarius brings people together is another reason to watch it.
That's a beautiful story.
I've been watching mostly things from like earlier in the year that I didn't see at the time, which I feel like I always wind up watching all the Sundance movies a year later, but yeah. I really liked White Girl a lot that I just saw yesterday, and it wasn't kids, which is what I thought it was going to be. And I really liked Demon a lot, this crazy Polish Israeli, like, slightly macabre story about
a
wedding.
I've heard of that.
I really love Demon as well.
Oh, did you?
Saw it too. Okay. Yeah.
And then Pervert Park. Here's a movie that's easy to sell. A documentary about a trailer park in Florida where registered sex offenders have to live together and get counseling. That was, like, I think it premiered 2.5 years ago, and it's taken that long for anybody to be like, okay, just put it out and don't talk about it. And it was so good.
I remember, like, that was at Sundance, like, when The Witch was, so like 2 years.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but
I remember it in the sort of Sundance program guide.
And it was already old then, because it turns out on IMDb it's a 2014.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
The length of time it takes some things to come out.
And I think it's 79 minutes, Nathaniel, so there's a sweet song that I can sing to you. It hasn't made filling out my ballot for you guys any easier. God damn it.
Oh, yeah. For those listening, you know, the Team Experience Awards, which we've been doing for 2 or 3 years or something. Because as contributor list has grown, I felt like there should be something other than my own awards. So everybody has their ballots due in that today. Yes. So that's coming up, and we will be back next week. All right. Thanks, Chris, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Very last minute. I'm glad you were awake.
Thank you very much for having me.